On today's podcast, Dr. Aditi Paul joins me to discuss her new book, The Current Collegiate Hookup Culture. My name is Justin Hamilton, and I'm hoping you'll swipe right for today's Big Squid. Welcome to today's podcast. It's a really fun one too. Dr. Paul is a dating and relationships researcher. She's also a professor based in New York City. She's way too smart to be on this podcast. It's really overwhelming, but she is fantastic, and she has used her dual background in technology and relationship science and used that to combine the two skills to examine how dating apps are transforming people's personal and sex lives. I know, it's a sexy chat. Dr. Paul is literally an expert in technology and relationships. So keep that in mind while she's talking to me, someone who identifies as app and relationship curious at best. I really enjoyed recording this. Not only is Dr. Paul crazy entertaining, but she also busts open some myths we might have held about the different generations and the world we live in now, especially in this post-lockdown world. It's a very fascinating world that we're entering, and I think you'll be surprised by some of her research and some of the things that she has learned in the process. I'll swing by at the end of the podcast, but let's get straight into today's chat by bringing in the fantastic Dr. Aditi Paul. So I think you will find this amusing. I was telling some people I know that I was about to be doing this interview with you, and the response from everyone was, oh, that sounds interesting. Are you allowed to talk about that? And I think they were mostly being funny, but I think there was also a hint of truth to it. And I wondered, when you were starting this, were you in any way kind of coming up against this pushback of, you know, sex, it's, you know, some people get a bit squeamish about it, some people get quite conservative about it. Did you come up against that? And if so, how did you overcome those barriers?
I am the younger child of two. And whenever I did anything since I was a child, if my elder sister did it, I would take it as a permission that I could do it too. And I used the same strategy when I was doing this research, because I based my research completely on the gaps that were left by previous researchers. So they asked all the spicy questions. That gave me the audacity, or it smoothed out the route that I took to measure all the variables that I measured in my study, because I was not the first one talking about sex. I was not the first one talking about hookups, because the research on hookups or college-based sexual encounters started in the year 2000. I mean, people were learning about how college students have sex before that, but this idea of hookups or casual sex, it's a 20 to 25-year-old conversation. So I was not starting something that was radical. Like, I wish I was that much of a deviant human, but I'm honestly not. So yeah. I rode in the shoulder of the sneaky giants that went before me, and yeah, they paved the way for me to ask these questions and just address the gaps that they left and update it, if you may.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because like when everyone's in that age bracket, they, you know, they want to explore their sexuality and how relationships work, and they want to try, you know, I'm going to date this kind of person, I'm going to date that kind of person. And then there just seems to be a tipping point, doesn't it? And I wonder if it's just when you become a parent where you suddenly, it seems like an age becomes deeply conservative about it, and it's disappointing, isn't it, to a certain extent? Like, can't you be more open-minded and still, you know, have moved on from that era in your life?
We wish, right? I mean, our teens and our young adult years are, of course, the years where we explore ourselves, and I was doing some research on it, and it's called emerging adulthood is what it is. And what has happened is this emerging adulthood, this age, or the age that we consider people to be in their emerging adulthood years, seems to have shifted. So maybe you and I had our emerging adulthood years between 18 to 24. But because of COVID, because of this huge reset that we had,
right,
it's almost like the people who were in their 19s and 20s seem to have regressed, right? I mean, they're back in their parents' home. They're in the same bedroom that they spend their junior prom and senior prom in. So they must have regressed. So their emerging adulthood years may have shifted a little bit, where they're having delayed adulthood experiences. So when you do that, you have those experiences that we might have had in our 18, 19-year-olds, they're having in their 20 to 24-year-olds. So anyways, we were doing that, right? I mean, if you look at the statistics, the age at which people get married is shifting.
Yeah.
And you can attribute it to social factors, you can attribute it to medical factors, you can attribute it to financial factors. People are not getting married as soon as they would have, especially women, like our previous generation. So you add that together with this reset. So now you're getting adult individuals who are exploring their sexuality, who are having fun with it because they're maturing at a delayed time.
I had not even really thought about the COVID aspect of it. And that is really fascinating to me because you're right. It's like just as there's that very specific age where, you know, you're like 18, 19 and you're like, right, I'm going to go out. I'm going to meet people. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And then 2 years later, they're like, oh, my Lord, I know everything about my parents and this is too much. And now I have to do it. And it kind of comes with a different fervor, doesn't it? It comes with a different energy because now it's like, now I've got to go and kind of, rather than let it come to me, I've got to kind of go and look for it a little bit more, I guess. Is that right?
I mean, are you saying that they're, now that they have come out of their cocoons,
it's a
huge push for them to like go out and seek out these opportunities or seek out these exploratory experiences that would have earlier been handed to them? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So, you know, like it's rather than letting it come to you just as it would naturally, now it's like, oh, I guess you have to go and seek it a little bit more, or maybe it's even for some people, maybe it's even a little bit more daunting because you've maybe had too long to think about it as well, rather than let it just happen. I'm a stand-up comedian, so last year, I went and did a university gig, and it was a really fun gig, but, you know, like, at the time, I was 48, and the audience is young, and I remember one girl's specific face for the whole half hour that I was on stage, and she was up the back, and she just looked so confused, because it was like, I've just spent all this time with my parents, and now one of my parents' friends is talking at me.
Oh my God! Yeah. Oh. I can just picture her face. How did that go? Did they have a good laugh?
The gig was great, but she was the one there was about 200 kids there and they were fantastic, but she was the one that I kept looking at and she was making me laugh so much because I looked at her and I was thinking, yeah, I get it. Like, yeah, I totally get it.
I get it. Yeah. Like, you did not sign up for this life. I totally understand.
Yeah. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry that I'm 48. I can't do anything about this.
On behalf of the entire generation, I apologize. Like,
I get that expression. I totally understand.
Yeah. Oh, so, trust me. I get that too.
Oh, do you? Yeah. Right.
Oh, yeah.
So where did this project start? What was the germination point for you to kick off with this?
The germination point was my apartment. was luckily the last day. I still remember this was 2020. It just sounds funny that I know that it's 2 years away, but like time is a concept right now. But my university is in New York, so our university shut down, and I checked out this last book from the library. How nerdy am I that I'm talking about checking out library books before the pandemic?
Love it.
I'm gonna own it. So and that book was American Hookup, The New Culture of Sex on Campus. And I picked up another book to increase my nerdiness. It's Boys and Sex by Peggy Orenstein. How we think boys interact with the idea of sex, or like how we think they do. So I picked up these two books, and when I was reading the first one, that is American Hookup, The New Culture of Sex on Campus, it's a brilliantly written book. It talks about how, like you said, how the 4 years of college or university is a wild party where you know as a student that this is the time that you can enjoy. You have a market cap, so you're going to optimize this. So she talks about this, the researcher talks about how women dress up and they go to parties, and how men are there and how they grind on each other. Do you know about grinding? Yeah. I can educate you about grinding. Look at you, in with the times.
I'm in with the times. Do you want to explain for people who might not know what grinding is?
I'm curious how you know what grinding is.
Well, isn't grinding just, you know, clothes on, kind of, you know, almost making out, simulating sex, but not actually having sex? Yes, or have I got that completely wrong?
You have that right, but like in what setting? In what setting?
Like usually, like not in front of people. Like, isn't it?
Oh,
like,
so you're thinking about dry humping? So,
I am thinking about dry humping, but
you're thinking about dry humping. So grinding is a dance that happens at college parties where women's butts are on men's pelvises and they're grinding on each other. So that's grinding.
Right.
And I remember seeing this in 2010 when I came from the US, came from India to the US as a PhD student, not helping my nerdiness. And I saw, I went to bars and I saw like people just dancing like that. I'm like, what is happening? And that's the way college kids dance. I don't know what's happened at the bars right now because A, I am not 21 anymore, and B, the college bars in New York City are not. I mean, I haven't seen any of these like college bars, so I don't know. I'm outside of that realm, but that's what happens. So, kids get drunk, they grind on each other. Sometimes they just like the women are just approached by guys from the back, and the women don't even know how the guy looks. So they look at their women friends to see if the guy is hot or not, and if they are, she turns around if she's inebriated enough, and if she's turned on enough, and they make out. And if it gets too charged up, they go to the guy's or girl's private place and they have sex. So this was the setup.
Right.
What a conventional hookup was. And I'm like, this is great. I mean, this is what I've seen. This is what I know. But then my research has always been in online dating. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, where is the conversation around apps? Like, how are dating apps affecting this already existing culture on campuses? And we're talking about a predominantly heterosexual hookups now. And we're talking about white hookups. What about hookups of minorities, sexual minorities? What about hookups of racial minorities, right? So where are those variables at play? So dating apps, racial minority, sexual minority. These are some of the gaps that I started identifying. And that led me to asking all these questions that, okay, now that we have dating apps as this player in a culture of sex, is that igniting it, putting in flames, and how is it, or is it making space for non-conventional or audiences that were in the minority in college campuses? So we're talking about racial minority, we're talking about women, we're talking about LGB community, we're talking about international students, right? So those were some of the gaps that I started noticing, and I filled it in with my study.
You know, I find the whole dating app thing to be fascinating in itself, because I've never been on them. I've never, I'm quite clearly in my late 40s, but even when my friends were getting into it, I was always against the idea of an algorithm, setting you up with someone. I'm not against other people using them, but just because, you know, we might both like basketball, it doesn't mean we like basketball for the same reasons. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it always seems like it was a flattening out of your interests into dot points rather than the emotional connection that you have to those things. So just even hearing everything that you were saying then, it was like, oh my Lord, there's just this whole world that I haven't even thought about because I'm surface level, you know, conservative with the idea of that. So getting right into it, I guess there's been a real positivity, as you were talking about, with minorities, because maybe back before apps, it was harder to meet people, but now you can use the apps to find like-minded people on campus. Is that correct?
That is correct. And, you know, online dating, online spaces in general has been the recluse, or has been a space for different sorts of marginalized communities. And I'm not talking about marginalized in terms of like oppression. No. Yeah, we're talking about specialized, let's say, communities or lean markets, as you may call it. So, for example, if you're Muslim and you are liberal towards sex, but you only want to hook up with people who are of the same religion, where do you find them? Like, do you go on and knock on people's head and like, oh, do you believe in Islam? Like, no, we're not gonna do that. Or Christianity or whatever. Like, pick your category. Things that are not that evident, or things or categories that are not the status quo in a particular community, and that is important to you. Where do you find them? Well, then you have to go to an algorithm. Talking about, you know, age-wise dating, I mean, online dating, one of the larger markets are individuals who are of a certain age on the higher spectrum, and they're divorced, maybe, like they're re-entering, you know, the life of dual intimacy. These are people who you don't just meet willy-nilly on the street. So you have to resort to the filters that an algorithm provides. The other day, I went for a campus interview, and the chances of her listening to it is very slim. So, like, I'm just going to say it. Not that it's not a popular podcast. It's just like, I don't think she will.
It's okay. There's a lot of podcasts out there. I think we're going to be okay.
She's in the middle of America. I don't know. Is your podcast going there? Like, you'll tell me through the analytics. So she said that she matched with, she's a lesbian woman, and she is in a very small town in middle America, and she has divorced her partner, and she's in her like 50s. So she met somebody who she really vibed with, who lives in another state where they have to drive 2 hours to go there. What are the chances of her finding a compatible partner of that sexual orientation in that place at that age, if not for dating apps? So we really have to ask the question, when we're asking these questions, is it beneficial for somebody? Well, who do you have in mind? Who do you have in mind? But on the other hand, for people who do belong to the status quo, they have their own sets of problems, where college students, they are on multiple dating apps. They are on multiple dating apps for multiple reasons. Some of them want to get over their ex-boyfriend. Some of them have taken a really good picture and want to feel validated. Some of them want to just have a good time during the talking phase. Some of them want to have sex. Some of them want to have a relationship. It's a playground for them. There's a lot of burnout in dating apps, for sure.
A good friend of mine is you know, recently divorced and not that old, you know, still in her 30s, and look, I have to be honest, the monthly calls I get from her, she lives in another city, she gives me updates as to what's been going on. It's amazing the way things can unravel in such, like, not terrible ways, but just interesting. Like, she had one guy who, you know, my friend just said, hey, are you dating anyone else? It's completely fine, but I'm just curious because it's just good to know this is only our second date. Mm-hmm. And he ended up, after that, calling it off by text because he saw it as really intrusive to be asking her that. And that's after she went out of her way to say, I'm just curious, like, you know, I'm just trying to get a handle on where we're at. And you know, she was still kind of mulling over other people as well. And just that, just that level of honesty. He saw it as a real affront. And I told her, I thought it actually worked out well that he called it off now, because imagine if he's going to get offended by that, imagine what he was going to get offended by later.
Oh my gosh, yes. I all my sentences start like that, where I saw this meme and I saw this TikTok. where this guy is like, he says, dating in 2022 is like, you know you're not the only one. You just hope you're the favorite one. And right. You felt that. And I'm like, this is, yeah, because what do you call that, exclusivity anymore, especially in the dating phase? And I give it up to your friend for having such a healthy perspective. Like, you know, in the books, we can all like aspire to be that, but to actually do that in real life, that requires a certain set of sense of detachment and self security.
Yeah.
To even ask that question and say, hey, just want to be transparent. Do you have anybody else? And if you do, it's okay. I just want to know. But I think, you know, more than honesty, we are just becoming very non-confrontational. That's something that I read in this book called Reclaiming Conversations by, now it's a great, Sherry Turkle, there you go. Reclaiming Conversations by Sherry Turkle. And she talks about, her entire premise of the book is that the digital technology, with everything that it gives us, is great. It's also compromising certain human characteristics or certain human abilities that we need to have for growth. And one of them is being uncomfortable during conversations. When me and you, we are having a conversation, and let's say you've been in situations where you've said a joke and it's fallen flat.
It's never happened. Just have not. I understand the concept, but
firecracker. Firecracker. See, this is what I'm talking about. Like, I made an assumption about you, didn't work. But the fact that, you know, we can navigate that discomfort without resorting to looking at our phone.
Yeah.
That capacity, or the ability to get bored, or the ability to have a face-to-face conversation, not just like to have a face-to-face conversation, but to navigate these like bits and bobs, the things, it's like tango, like these moves that we don't see coming. And to grow that skill set, we kind of lost that because you know, digital communication has made it so easy for us to just cut the cords and just pause. And now with, like, you know, iPhone, with updates to unsend, to edit, we're forgetting the spontaneity or the awkwardness that's so inherent in human communication.
Yeah, you know, something that you said just really resonated with me, which is the ability to navigate boredom. And, you know, it's not a bad thing to get to a place with someone where you're a little bit like, well, I've kind of told all my stories and you've told all of your stories, but I'm still enjoying hanging out. So now I'm going to have to dig deep. I'm going to have to go an extra layer down to kind of pull this situation out. You know, you just can't walk away. I wonder if it is something else that inspires in me is the ability to have a conversation that's a disagreement that doesn't devolve into either shutting down or it turning into, you know, it's like you're speaking in all capital letters and size 26 Helvetica font at each other, you know. And I wonder if
that's very specific. Do you do that?
Look, it seems like that's what comes into my head anytime I end up in that situation. But
Helvetica 27.
Yeah, just a very specific one. But I wonder if that's from social media as well, where like people, because people can attack you from any angle and it's nobody that you know, we've lost the ability to, you know, just come from different opposing viewpoints, and that's fine as well.
It's very tricky, is what I can tell you. It's very tricky. And this is something that I discussed in another podcast as well, where the way we even select our sexual partners, I mean, think about the wild 60s and 70s and even millennials, like we were thrown into this forest of technology without even right. knowing how to navigate it. And yeah. when we were exploring our sexual choices, we didn't really have things like, are you pro-abortion or are you anti-abortion, or are you this or are you that? Not to say that they are not very important issues. They're absolutely crucial. But since those choices were not in the forefront, we didn't register that. So yeah. I can talk in terms of, like, you know, my upbringing has been in India. So I have like an international and a national outlook toward what is happening in the US. And I can talk about how the culture in India has shifted because of, you know, the radicalization that happens through social media, where I identify as Hindu and I had Christian friends and I had Muslim friends. So we don't have racial diversity, but we for sure have linguistic diversity. We for sure have racial diversity. But when I was hanging out with my friends back then, I never thought of those things. Like, right. I never thought of the fact that this, I'm hanging out with a Muslim or a Christian or a Catholic friend, or I'm hooking up with this guy. No, like, we didn't think about that. Not to say that those issues were not important, but those things have been militarized by social media, by propaganda, whatever you may call it. Now we look at the world through those filters, and our sexual attractiveness or romantic attractiveness towards these toward people who are an other, based on whichever category we believe in, is impeded because of that filter. So in a way, we are moving toward the future with very traditional values. So we're fooled into believing that, oh, we live in 2022, we have all this new technology, but with heck are traditional values. So right. what is progress, right? In that way, I don't know if this is a, I don't think this is a healthy culture at all. We just need to be mindful of it. And the pendulum has swung way to the left. It's going to swing back to the central point where we understand, wait a minute, this is not helping us as a collective. And we go back to what we were. Right. But for right now, it seems very dysfunctional.
Well, the arguments are too binary, aren't they? It's either yeah. you're against something or you're for something. And
oh, yeah.
and often most topics are really nuanced and really, yeah. really complicated. And mm-hmm. I think I consider myself quite left in my way of thinking, but I hate the militant left, and I hate the militant right, and I
Absolutely.
Think they cause so much trouble. And what the militant left really fails to do, in my perspective, is that it comes up with good ideas and you know, ways of moving forward, and then it pushes the probably the moderate right, it pushes it towards mm. the more militant side of it, and mm. then in the process gets caught up arguing amongst itself about, you know, I'm a feminist, no, you're not the right type of feminist, no, yeah. this is how a feminist is, and meanwhile the right's becoming more and more militant over here. And so it's just frustrating, because we can make this progress, we just got to keep the lines of communication open and have empathy. You know, that seems to be the thing yeah. that's lost in yeah. discussion, the lack of empathy.
Yeah, I totally understand that. The other day, you know, Elon Musk put out this tweet, I don't know if you saw it, where he made this argument that there was a central point, yeah. and picture, like, there's a line, there's a central point, and there's a right and a left. So it's the right person is a right wing, the left person is a left wing. And then certain things happen, and that midpoint has shifted toward the side where, even if you were, shifted toward this side. So a person who was previously left has become right now.
Oh, right,
and,
right.
Yeah, so like, and I thought, that looks true. And then immediately after that, I send this to one of my friends who does political communication, and he's like, this is not true. This is the actual truth is, and another professor or another scholar who has done his research, he put a citation and he said, actually, the midpoint has shifted in a way where previously left people, previously right people have become even more radicalized. So it's almost like because we are so egotistical about our viewpoints, even if when we are wrong, just because we need to be right, we stay in the right, yes, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So it's become highly, highly calcified. And it just has become, it's become like this personality thing. Like, don't make your entire identity that one opinion that you have. You know, we're so multidimensional, and nobody is a monolith. Like you, there are 10 categories to think about in lives. I cannot be the same person as you are in all those 10 categories. Doesn't mean that we cannot get along. So long as the 5 core that I have matches with the 5 core that you have. Other than that, we can work around it. And it's not helping when you're meeting through dating apps that you're meeting through these filters, right? So if you see somebody who is really beautiful and gorgeous and highly accomplished, but you see that they're liberal while you're conservative, you're like, cannot get along with you now.
Right.
When there are marriages that we see now that are Democrat and Republican marriages, how did they work it out? Just this instant cancellation based on categories is getting exhausting. It's just exhausting.
It was the key word I was thinking then. As you were saying that, I was like, oh my God, it's just so exhausting. It's so tiring. Everyone's just, you know, on edge. Yeah. After the last few years, and it's hard to find that middle ground. I feel like I've gotten way too far away from your work, and there are questions that I wanted to ask you about that. I'm curious, what was, because you talk about some of the assumptions that people have with the dating apps. I was wondering, what assumption did you have going in that ended up being different? And it might even be an assumption that you didn't realize that you had. But once you started doing your research, you went, oh, okay, that took me by surprise.
Mm. I thought dating apps were just like all the rave in college campuses. I thought like everybody's on a dating app. That was true. 75% of students are on dating apps. Like they've used one dating app at least in their lives. But only 25% of them said that they met their hookup partners through dating apps. So even when they have the chance of like having a casual fling, they are still resorting to their already existing network in schools and colleges. So when I asked them, who was the last person? Where did you meet them? 40% of them said that they met their last partner in their class or at a student club or something that happened within the college. 25% of them said that they met their partner on dating app. And out of those 25%, 60% identified as LGBT individuals. So this idea that online dating apps are like so popular among colleges, that is the go-to, it's not. And this alarm that we have going off in our head that, oh my God, kids have just forgotten how to meet face-to-face. No. A majority of them are still meeting their partners face-to-face. Their communication might have become mediated, but that inception, the context in which they're meeting their partners face-to-face, is still number one. So that was interesting for me. And when we think about hookups and we think about casual sex, we're thinking in very stereotypical ways where we're thinking these guys must be like absolutely crazy drunk and they're having sloppy sex. That and it's just so spontaneous. That happens at college parties, but dating app initiated hookups, they are extremely planned. They are planned. Right. Where this guy, he's a gay individual, he said he got lube, he got condoms, he dropped his location to his friend when he was going to hook up with this guy. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is planned, right? So the spontaneity or the instances of drunk sex happening on dating apps, very, very low.
Wow. I didn't even think of the... I feel like I keep saying this to you because this is all so new to me. What a great idea of, you know, dropping the pin for your friend. So, you know, you're like... It's not expecting the worst, but I'll
be
here.
Yeah.
Just so you know, I'll be right here. Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? So because, I guess is, first of all, why is there that view that the dating apps are leading to, you know, as you said, sloppy sex and these hookups? And how did that come about as the idea when it's actually the opposite? Is that just an older generation's fear of dating apps?
It's the narrative around it. You know, if you look at any movies or any television shows, the way they show dating apps are exactly that way. There's this two night stand or something. There was a movie where all the movies that you see on dating apps, they kind of skew toward that narrative that it's just like a one-off. It's just casual. It's a one night stand almost. And then there is this idea that Tinder is called a hookup app. So it's almost like, you know, there in Sydney, if I tell you this, that like, you know, is there something like a bar that has the reputation, which is like a hookup spot, like you just pick up people over there. You have these seedy bars, right, where people know that, oh, you're going into that bar, that means this is going to happen, right?
Yeah.
In the same way, like if you think about Tinder in that way, where people think or assume that if you're on Tinder, then at least you're looking for something casual. And that expectation can color the experience that you're having. And I always say this, that when I ask them this question, that when you met this person through the dating app, did you right swipe on this person thinking so that you right swiped on this person only to hook up? And a majority of them said no. Like, we didn't just go to Tinder to just hook up. We just happened to hook up from Tinder. And what happens with Tinder is you're meeting somebody who's a complete stranger, so the stakes are very low, and you've invested this time in talking to them. Even if they turn out to be dumb, you're like, let me just get a bang out of this, you know, like, let me just do something. Let me just enjoy myself physically if my emotional needs are not going to be met. So in that way, a lot of these like casual encounters turn into hookup encounters, but not to say that they're going there only to bone. No.
Yeah. First of all, I just need to point out, I have no idea where those bars are in Sydney. And if anyone would like to tell me, that would be fantastic. But you were saying, it is the narrative of movies and TV shows, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because that's a more thrilling story to tell, because
what's
an actual truthful story, it would not make a great movie. Oh, yeah, went on a couple of dates on Tinder, met some interesting people, it didn't work out. Anyway, that's 2 hours. Thanks for your money.
and you know, you have some of the stories. I saw it the other day, like, and this is getting more common, where they're showing the reality of dating apps, where the talking phase in dating apps is so long, right? I mean, it's almost like, think about it as a reality television show of endurance, right? I mean, you start with 10,000 participants and the hurdles keep getting higher and higher, and at the end of the day you have two people. It's the same in dating apps, where you have so many contenders, and then you right swipe, let's say out of 100 people you right swipe, let's say, argument's sake, 70 people. And after you right swipe 70 people, maybe like 30 of them say hi to you and you have a conversation. Out of those 30, maybe, slim chances, 5 are good conversations. Out of those 5, you're meeting 2. You've done all this work, and out of those 2, 1 ghosts you. So, you know, like, it's, or you ghost that person.
Yeah.
So you're playing against all these odds. So you've invested this much time just because they are not long-term boyfriend or girlfriend material. Like, do you not do anything? Because then what did I do for all this time? And that leads to short-lived relationships, even if you didn't start it like that.
Right. Yeah. You've the reality TV idea is such a great analogy, because it really is. Yeah. It's bringing it right down. That's a lot of work. That seems
That's
like an extraordinary amount of work.
Yeah.
You were saying in your work, there's the question, are LGBT students really more sexually liberal than straight students? I thought that was a really interesting question, because I think if you don't think about it, if you just ask that question, your immediate answer is, of course.
Yeah.
But and was that something that you were thinking when you went into it? And have you been disavowed of that thought, or is it where is
you
that
know,
at?
I feel so let down. I mean, I feel so let down as a straight female, where we are at the bottom rung of sexual satisfaction. It's like, what are we even doing? Yes, to your answer, yes, LGBT students are sexually more liberal than straight students. And the way I quantified being sexually liberal is attitudinally and behaviorally. So there is a sexual permissive scale that I administered. I administered a sexual disgust scale. I asked them, how many times do they masturbate? How many times do they watch porn? How many sexual partners they've had? So an aggregate of all those numbers across the board, gay men and bisexual women, gay men, bisexual men, and straight men, pretty much like on the same length. But in terms of sexual liberalness in the women front, bisexual women and lesbian women are leading the way. Straight women have sexually conservative attitudes. They masturbate less, and they are also the least likely to experience an orgasm in their last hookup. So what is happening?
That is devastating news.
That is just devastating. Like, it's become a concerted decision for me right now to stay straight. I'm like, should I? Should I? Is this God's way of telling me of just not being straight anymore? Like,
right, yeah.
Like, this is such a losing game at this point. And I'm like, what is happening? I don't know.
But why is that? Like, why are the women not experiencing an orgasm in hookups? Is it because on the if they're heterosexual women, is that because heterosexual men, like, maybe the blame's on them? Are they a bit useless? Is it a bit?
I don't want to. Yes, they are useless. I'm kidding. At the same time, you know, I was just reading this today where they said that feminism is not a fight against men. It's a fight against patriarchy, and patriarchy is a system. Lots of women can propagate patriarchy just the same way men can support feminism. And if you think about these gaps or these orgasm gaps in terms of those factors, where, to be honest with you, I am a product of the millennial generation, I may still have shards of patriarchal beliefs in me that I'm not questioning, which have not been questioned by society yet, right? So, for example, the kind of scripts I grew up with was ones of sexual conservativeness, right? And when you do delve into exploring your sexuality, you're programmed into thinking that, oh my gosh, like, I'm doing something that's out of the norm. I shouldn't be like complaining, or like my needs are not the highest, right? Because I'm almost living outside the law. So I was not taught to put my sexual pleasure first. So I didn't negotiate things that were happening in the bedroom. But now those narratives are changing. It changes with age. It changes with time. These women are still 18 to 24 year olds, and our belief system doesn't shift so radically over 10 years. So I would imagine they're still going through that phase where they are fighting against the sexual double standard that exists in society and still trying to make their space for themselves, right? And sometimes maybe they're not putting their sexual needs in front of them. Maybe they're not vocalizing it, not to their fault, because they don't know any better.
Right.
And it's only through experience that you learn that. And I think it's a false statement to say that men should just ask, women should just say, how comfortable are we talking about sex? I'd rather have sex than talk about sex. It's so cringy, right? So like to put all that onus on 18 to 24 year olds that, oh, you need to have sex, you need to explore yourselves, you need to talk about it, and you need to say if you haven't had an orgasm or not. Well, no, we have to give them time. So the experiences that they are having, especially women, is very reminiscent, or it has echoes of patriarchal beliefs or patriarchal sex norms. Because why else? Okay, you can still blame orgasm on men, right? Straight women blame the onus on men not giving them an orgasm. I understand that. But why are straight women not masturbating?
Right.
Why are we not doing that? And again, I don't want to victimize the victim here, but to understand that we have these invisible scripts that we work with, where even sexual exploration of oneself seems to be such a behavior from the anarchy, right? So to get to that position where I'm comfortable with my body, where I'm comfortable with my sexual agency, where the society supports my sexual agency, just like the support of cis men, it'll take time. But I hope that these results bring that to the forefront, because very often we just live in denial thinking that, oh, I'm doing all the work, I'm progressive.
Right.
But your behaviors and your attitudes don't show that.
It's crazy to not enjoy masturbation. Like, it's literally, you know, something that you can do.
Yeah,
and have the bed to yourself.
Yeah, it's 100% satisfaction. What are you talking about? Like, it is that. So that's something that was kind of alarming to me.
Right. You know, even talking about just sex in general can be so confronting for people. Even with people that you know really mm-hmm. well. And a story that I've told a couple of friends. So just getting back a little bit, I don't know if you had this during COVID, but in lockdown, mm-hmm. I had a lot of memory dreams, and it's because I wasn't, out and about and touring and stuff like that. It was like I kept waking up from these dreams where I'd go, mm-hmm. oh my God, I completely forgot about that. And mm-hmm. one of those memory dreams, and by the way, I found this story to be really funny, but the friends that I told were kind of troubled by, and I'll be curious to know, feel free if I tell you this story, say, Justin, that's really troubling and you're an idiot. But so when I was younger, I used to play basketball, and when I was in my under 16s basketball team, when I was 15, we used to play against the top women's team in under 20s, and we used to just train against each other at our same club. I was raised by a single mum. I get along well with women, and I got along well with the girls on that team. And then they invited me to a party once, and when I got there, I was the only guy from my team, and there were, you know, and it was hilarious because they just kind of were, it was almost like a collection of big sisters. That's you know. So anyway, we're all hanging out, and I remember there was one girl in particular, Lucy, who said to me, and she said this in front of everyone. She said, "Now, Justin, you are going to be 16 soon, and I just want to give you some advice. You are going to have nights where you want to hook up with a woman, and you are going to want to make phone calls to women. This is my advice: masturbate first, and then if you call that woman, that means you actually really like her." And everyone burst out laughing. And then she followed up with, "I guarantee you'll never make that call." And I just think that's I think it's a really funny story. And I think it's a really, you know, and not necessarily bad advice. And it was funny telling this.
It's great advice. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Oh my God. I'm going to give that to my nephew this time when I go and visit him.
Yeah. when he least expects it as well. Don't give any lead up. Just go the advice.
Yeah, just like masturbate, get your sexual tension out, and if you still like this person, then message them. It's the same as like, you know, drunk texting your ex. I mean, is it you or is it the vodka? Like,
yeah,
you wake up in the morning and you still want to drunk. I mean, if you still want to text him, then possibly you like the idea of going back, but sometimes it's just our hormones.
It's just the hormones. It's fine. Yeah. I should get to the end of... I should let you go. That's what I was trying to say. But there's so much stuff here, and I've really loved talking to you. Is there... I don't know quite what to ask you next because so much of it is really interesting. Is there anything that we should that you wanted to talk about that I've missed out, or is there any angle on your work? Or I'm putting you on the spot here, but
there's one, sugar dating, if you want to talk about that.
Yes, I do, please.
So tell me, like, you know, I've quizzed you about dry humping. I want to know what you know about sugar dating now.
So I'm guessing, so I've never heard the term before, as someone who has to watch your sugar levels, even the word sugar gets me up. But the
it's a trigger warning.
It's a trigger. Yeah, it is. So I'm guessing it goes back to sugar daddy, and it's young women maybe looking for older men to go on dates with them, and the guy kind of lavishing a lot of attention and making it a special night. Is that, am I in the right ballpark?
You're in the right ballpark. It's essentially compensated dating. It's mostly like older men looking for younger women, if I may put it that way. The demand is higher than the supply sometimes. That has become quite the norm in college campuses. So when I did my research, I saw 14% students said that they have used a sugar dating app.
There's an app.
Oh, there are multiple apps. There are multiple apps. Right. So there's one which is like the big daddy of it all. It's called Seeking Arrangement, which is currently just called Seeking. There is one which is What's Your Price? There is one which is Luke's or Lux. And What's Your Price? It's just right on the nose, right? It's just on the nose. It's interesting. If you ever get a chance, like if you go to seekingarrangement.com or Seeking, just look at the landing page and you'll see how they have packaged these sugar dating relationships. It's packaged in a way where they put you in a seat of empowerment where you were an older and you were an adult. You decide the terms of your relationship, yada, yada, yada. And sugar daddies are not called sugar daddies. They're called mentors or like benefactors. And sugar babies are not called sugar babies. They are ones who are ambitious individuals who like the finer things in life. Right. So it's packaged in a very empowering sort of narrative. And the stereotypical way of thinking about sugar dating is, oh, you'll have an older gentleman or you'll have an older man. I don't know if he's going to be gentle or not, but he's an older man. And then you have younger women. Now what we see is there are sugar mamas as well. And so sugar mamas looking for sugar babies who are men, but also sugar daddies looking for gay men. So a lot of these college students are gay men who are partnering up with older men who might still be closeted. And the interaction between them is of a sexual nature, but does not always have to be sex. So what that means is you can send some racy pictures of yourself. Believe it or not, some people make $500 by sending pictures of their feet.
Oh, yeah.
So that's there. And when I ask sugar babies, like, why do you sugar date? Common belief is that they will say there's such crippling debt. College is not cheap in the U.S. It's like $140,000 or more. The narrative that they'd want us to believe these sugar dating websites, is it's like a financial relief program of sorts of college students, that they're making all this money and they're paying off their debt. They're not doing that. Their parents are taking care of it, or the government, or the bank loans are taking care of that. What they are using their money for is discretionary expenses. So looking good on Instagram and, you know, just flexing on the gram is what they say. It's just living, enjoying life with the money that they make.
Look, if I could get into anything, if I could make money from just taking photos of my feet, I'd be totally up for that.
Who wouldn't?
Like, seems like a pretty good way to go, right? I'll just take a photo, send it off.
Yeah, it's a great way. I mean, I think it's a good way to democratize, you know, sexual relations. I would just make people aware, like, just be safe, and you know, like Gen Z, because they are digital natives, they've grown up with technology. They, for example, like when I talked about dropping the location, like these are things that they do, so they are savvy. What I would encourage them is to like. Hold on to that savviness, that because there's such a power differential and there's such a dynamic. But not to say that they are in a less powerful position, because they too hold the gun on their sugar daddies and sugar mamas where they can leak them, but they're not. So there is a level of trust, but it can get predatorial, is all I'm trying to say.
Right. Yeah. It's a fascinating piece of work, and I've loved talking to you, and I would love to do more of it, actually. That's been really interesting, and it's nice to be in a space where you can kind of talk about this stuff and really explore these ideas. With people listening to this podcast, where can they find you? Where can they find your work?
Oh, please find me. I would encourage you to not buy my book. I'm going to tell you that, because the book is priced at $95. Please save those $95. You don't have to buy my book. Ask your library to buy my book. That's what I would suggest that you do. Ask your library to buy my book. And if you do want to support me, I am on Instagram. I'm on Twitter with the handle I am Aditi Paul, AditiPaul. And I'm on LinkedIn with Dr. Aditi Paul. I have my website, DrAditiPaul.com. Please reach out. Let me know if you agree with something that I said. Reach out. If you don't agree with something that I said that does not hold true for the Australian audience, I would love to hear from you. So please reach out.
Oh, yeah. I have some really fun and interesting listeners, so I will not be surprised if you get in touch with me and say, I just heard from blah, blah, blah. And I'll go, oh, yeah, no, that was one of the ones I thought might reach out.
So, oh, I'm so excited. Oh, thank you so much for having me.
No worries. That was fantastic. Thank you, Aditi. Big thank you to Dr. Paul for this fun podcast. What a treat to have her on as a guest, and hopefully we can find some time to have her come back and answer more questions about just what is going on out there. Yeah, look, I haven't run this past her, but maybe I should let you ask the questions next time. I'll have to have a think about that one. That seems like a pretty good idea. I wonder if she'd be up for it. I hope she'd be up for it. That was fun. I'd like to get her back on a regular basis. Remember, over at bigsquidpod.com, you can find my Dispatches from the Fury Road blog with the latest about the season finale of HBO's Barry. And more so, what does a creator owe their audience? I personally love season 3. I thought it was the best of them so far. I've loved it since the first series. But I know some people weren't into the darker turn it took along the line here. I can't say that that's incorrect, you know, because everyone's taste is their taste, but it made sense to me. Like, it always seemed like a darker show, and it was also still funny. But anyway, that was the inspiration for the new blog, so you can find that over at the site. Also, over at Patreon, you can access bonus podcasts, articles, scripts, and more. I recently, last weekend, uploaded a whole lot of bonus material for the Dogs in Space episode that Garth and I had for Pass the Amel. I really love that film, so there's a lot of extra things there that I've put up so you can have access to them. If you think something like that might appeal to you, if you feel like you're not getting enough of me in your life, head to patreon.com/JustinHamilton_BigSquid to find a tier that suits you. If you'd like to support our work, but money is tough, and I do understand that money is, 2022, it's a lot of work, and it is a very challenging year for a lot of us. So you can still help out by giving us a top review on Apple Podcasts, or you know what, just even word of mouth is pretty fantastic. And just listening to the podcast, that's great too. So thank you. Once again, I really appreciate you listening. I'll be back next week with a new Deep Dive Director episode. It is David Lynch's delightful film, The Straight Story. Yeah, I know. I just used the adjective delightful. And yes, it's about a David Lynch film. I know, some of you are probably thinking, I don't know if I trust you on this, but you should.
It is a completely and utterly delightful film. And if you haven't seen it, you know, go and check it out. Go and check it out before the podcast, or wait for the podcast and then hopefully we'll win you over. This is just such a sweet film. I really loved it. And we also have a return from an old friend of the podcast who hasn't been on for a while. So keep an eye out for that. I hope you're well, and I hope you're having a good time with loved ones and friends. Until then.